This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. We're going to talk a little bit about more about COVID. Switzerland joining Spain and the UK and suggesting that the virus pandemic may be shifting to an endemic phase. You've got the White House moving to prevent future shortages of COVID-19 tests, ensuring they continue to be produced in large number. Creedy, a lot going on. Australia's cases are surging. It's just a reminder, it's a global pandemic, and until we all get through it, we're all going to have to deal with it.
Yeah, it really speaks to the fact that vaccine, or I should say COVID fatigue, is absolutely a factor here. A lot of people saying, well, you know, we're done with this. We're going to just live our lives as normal. And some case numbers show that maybe you can't do that just yet.
Speaking of COVID fatigue, some of those who get COVID, it's sticking around for a long time, those long haulers. Let's get to that and more with Dr. Betty Rahman, principal investigator of the Radcliffe Department of Medicine at the University of Oxford. She joins us on the phone from Oxford, England. Dr. Rahman, nice to have you here with us. How are you, and what are you seeing when it comes to the progression of COVID in the UK?
Thanks, Carol. I'd like to take this opportunity to say, really appreciate this invitation. COVID is still very high. The number of cases are still very high in the UK. An increasing concern for many is the long-term effects of COVID. As you might know, long COVID is a syndrome that some people may experience beyond the acute phase. It's a serious global health concern and has already affected 1.3 million people here in the UK. That constitutes more than 2% of our population, and it is estimated that more than 50 million worldwide will be affected by long COVID, and that many will continue to be diagnosed with ongoing symptoms and complications from COVID.
We heard a statistic, and I'm not sure if your team shared it with our producer, but is it correct that nearly one quarter of virus survivors will have some kind of long-term effect?
Yes, that's true. So roughly about 24-25% can have some type of long-term effect.
Talk to us a little bit about, one, what that looks like and how you actually go about addressing it.
Yeah, so this is what people are commonly referring to, long COVID or post-acute sick leave COVID or PASC. Long COVID is defined by persistence of symptoms beyond 3 months of infection. The most common manifestation is fatigue, but people can report a range of symptoms, including headaches, body pain, gastrointestinal symptoms, brain fog. So there are a multitude of symptoms that people experience. We know that it really affects someone's ability to return to work, that more than 50% of people with long COVID have either not been able to return to work or have returned to modified duties. So it has huge implications for the economy.
What can we do about it?
So I think we're still looking for answers. There has been some evidence that the mitochondria of the muscle, which is basically the powerhouse of all the cells, might be contributing to the symptom of fatigue. There's certainly some preclinical studies showing that the virus might hijack the mitochondria and affect the cell's ability to fight the infection and promote inflammatory pathways. So we're particularly interested in testing a treatment or a therapy that Accela Therapeutics have developed. It's called AXA1125, a mixture of five amino acids, which has been shown to have a beneficial effect to the mitochondria and also result in meaningful reduction in other markers of inflammation, liver fat, and even insulin resistance.
So when we talk about long COVID, just how long is long? Are we talking about weeks, months, years even?
Yeah, so some of the patients we've seen who've volunteered for our study have had long COVID have had ongoing symptoms since March 2019. So, 2020. So this is, we're talking about really protracted symptoms for some people, but the definition that the UK has introduced by NICE refers to symptoms beyond 3 months of infection.
What's the timeline in terms of this treatment that you talk about that might help with these COVID long haulers? Is this something that we'll see maybe put into use later on this year? Just got about 30 seconds left here.
Yeah, so we hope to have some results by mid-2022. Okay. The study has already started. Recruitment is well underway. There's been a huge number of participants interested, and the first patient has been dosed with the treatment. So so we've got some, it looks really promising just in terms of reaching our target and finishing the study quite early on. And we hope that there's some positive news for mm-hmm. patients worldwide.
We'll look forward to hearing more on that as you guys go through the testing process. Dr. Betty Rahman, Principal Investigator for the Radcliffe Department of Medicine at University of Oxford, on the phone from Oxford. Another story I just want to mention having to do with COVID from the Associated Press. The U.S. Army, for the first time, offering a maximum enlistment bonus of $50,000 to highly skilled recruits who join for 6 years. The AP learning this as the service struggles to bring in soldiers into critical jobs amid the continuing pandemic, so they too, Creedy, are dealing with a work shortage.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, this week's Bloomberg Business Week, it's all about the year ahead. The cover story, the issue, is about the biggest dangers to the economy, the global economy this year. And folks, surprise, surprise, it's really not about COVID. For more, let's bring in our senior executive editor for economics at Bloomberg, head of Bloomberg Economics, Stephanie Flander. She is with us on the phone in London, along with Bloomberg Business Week editor Joel Weber on the Axis line in Brooklyn. You know, Joel, the TYA issue, I love it. It always looks into, you know, what's going to go on maybe and what are the stories that are going to dominate this year. But so much of what happens this year depends on kind of global bankers getting it right. And I'm talking about, you know, we're talking about central bankers getting it right.
Yeah, and talk about a well-timed story, right? Just on, mm-hmm. the, on the heels of yesterday. And, you know, we try and gaze into a crystal ball as much as we can in this issue. We always feel like whenever we're talking about the year ahead, people are just like, want to always know what's going on with the economy. And I think that is especially true now. Living through what we've all lived through, the unprecedented nature of not only COVID, but also the responses to COVID. And now we find ourselves somewhere, hopefully maybe on the back end, and we get to deal with, you know, the aftermath of all of this. But, you know, like you said in the top there, COVID perhaps maybe not the central theme that we have to wrestle with now. We've seen what the response can look like and mm-hmm. how we can manage. So Stephanie, over to you. What job is it that the central bankers have to wrestle with now?
They have to work out whether the global economy is kind of, especially the U.S. economy, if you're the Fed, is permanently changed as a result of COVID, that they should really take seriously the idea that people don't want to go back to their jobs, you know, having trouble filling jobs, that we're really going to have inflation kind of endemic in the economy rather than just being this transitory thing. Or whether actually we are all going to be going back to normal, the economy is going to be more or less like it was in a year or so's time, and they just need to kind of sit tight and, you know, tweak a few levers and raise a few interest rates, but fundamentally they don't have to grapple with something different. And the risk is that at the end of the year, it turns out that they just called that wrong, that, for example, inflation really is a big issue. Financial markets are losing confidence in the central bank's kind of understanding of the situation, and we face a big problem.
Stephanie, these aren't exactly synchronized moves when you're talking about central banking, and you have the PBOC, for example, continuing to ease, the ECB essentially pausing, the Fed, even emerging markets, hiking as quickly as they can, or at least that's what the market is telling us they're going to do. How much of that kind of dislocation across the world is a problem for the global economy?
Because those disparate forces this is a new moment there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that was interesting. One of the things I was sort of thinking about as I wrote the piece is you have on the one hand a kind of familiar dynamic of, you know, if the Federal Reserve raises interest rates, well, it's the emerging market economies that could face the biggest problems as a result of that. They kind of get the long end of that story. But actually, there's a whole other thing going on, which is China's already slowed down a bit. And for the first time ever, really, certainly in living memory, the People's Bank of China is going to do something different from the Fed. They've always had to slavishly follow the Fed because they had their exchange rate tied to the dollar. They've kind of won their own declaration of independence from developing their economy and changing their policies. and they now have the freedom to cut interest rates just as the Federal Reserve is raising them. So that is an interesting moment for the global economy, with the Eurozone kind of staying, as always, a few steps behind, still waiting even for that much inflation, let alone a problem needing to raise rates.
Okay, so, I mean, Stephanie, the fact that China's going one way, U.S. is going another, but even just the fact that we have, I did a bit of crosstalk there, so forgive me, but the fact that we have everyone not working in lockstep for a change, that is radically different, right? And so what does that start to look like? If you're Powell, for instance, and you're trying to control what you can control, but then there's all these other forces that could perhaps work against you, how much of that the calculus starts to have to factor in that stuff?
Well, it certainly affects the way the financial markets think, right? Because you've got the Eurozone more or less on hold, so you know, there is a certain amount of pressure pulling down the cost of money, pulling down long-term interest rates, bond yields, even as you've got the Federal Reserve maybe doing 4, maybe 5, maybe 6 rate rises this year. We don't know. So that is a different dynamic, but we're not all dancing to the same tune as the U.S. But I think it is still fundamentally the case. The most important story is going to be what happens to inflation in the U.S., what happens to inflation expectations. Do people trust that the Fed knows what it's doing? And as a consequence of that, of course, what happens in financial markets.
What's so tricky, Stephanie, right? And the question on your piece is which way to normal. Do we really know what normal? Is it a new normal on the other side of the pandemic? Isn't that part of the problem?
Yeah, and that's what I found kind of curious. And it made me think about it writing this piece. And I was so glad of the editor asking me to do it just before Christmas.
That's called knowing your audience, Stephanie. Well done.
I look at the forecast and I sort of thought, it's funny because I've also written and we've had economic research around the COVID having boosted productivity in some areas, you know, businesses that had to bring in automation much faster than they expected. Everyone working from home and therefore being more digitally enabled in their work, you know, that this was actually going to make us more productive, weirdly, and almost produce like a COVID dividend. So there was that whole discussion, but and, you know, other ways in which people felt there was a fundamental change, maybe in supply chains, you know, because of what's happened in China and what happened during COVID. And then you look at the forecasts, and maybe economists are just not very, you know, original or imaginative people, but they're all kind of expecting, despite all of what we consider to be really important changes in the microeconomy, they somehow think the macroeconomy is going to carry on more or less the same after this year. And that does seem like a bit of a disconnect. Like, who's going to turn out to be right? Are we really transformed as a result of COVID? Or is this just, you know, a lot of this much less permanent than we think?
All right, we're going to leave it on that note. It's an incredible story, and Joel's right. It's so timely considering hearing from Jay Powell and all these Fed central bankers, or Fed bankers, I should say, this week. I mean, this is really front and center. So an incredible story and a great read and so relevant. Stephanie, thank you. Stephanie Flander, Senior Executive Editor, Head of Bloomberg Economics at Bloomberg News, on the phone from London. And our thanks to Joel Weber as well, Editor of Bloomberg Business Week, on the Access Line from Brooklyn. I love this issue. It's the year ahead. It's looking at what's ahead in the economy, what's ahead in politics, what's ahead in terms of how we consume. It's going to be all in our weekend show, but it's really a really smart issue. And it'll be on newsstands tomorrow. Some of the stories already on the Bloomberg and also at Bloomberg.com. More coming out this week.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Interesting story that popped up on our radar. It also happens to be in Bloomberg Business Week's Year Ahead issue, which is out on newsstands tomorrow on the Bloomberg and also at Bloomberg.com. And Kriti, it's about how there is still no Amazon for housing, but there's some fintech companies, they're working on it.
It's in the works. But I mean, remember, we've had a rough couple of months when it comes to Zillow and some of the other peers. And for that, for more information on that sector, we got to bring in the experts here. And that, of course, is Patrick Clark. He covers real estate for Bloomberg. He's on the phone from right here in New York City. Patrick, thank you for joining us. I loved your story because there's a line that stuck out to me where it said it made sense to order pants online, but many consumers still prefer brick and mortar grocery stores where they can squeeze the avocado and eye the steak. I guess houses are no different. Tell us more about it.
Yeah, I mean, every house is different, just like every piece of fruit, I guess. It's been the great challenge for companies, particularly tech companies, but I guess all companies that are looking for ways to to sort of carve out a either a small or large niche in the U.S. housing market. At the end of the day, they're really not, a house is really not a commodity good. Even a sort of mass-produced house that looks like all the houses next to it, like every house has a different view, and every house will, you know, age in different ways. And not only, for the most part, literally, do home buyers want to actually go squeeze the house, but it's just very hard to take the human element out of buying and selling one.
So, wait, are you saying that there isn't a Carvana approach to buying a house? We can't go to a kiosk and say, yeah, I'd like that split level?
I love that you said Carvana, because it's how a lot of the companies, a lot of the prop tech, as they call themselves, prop tech companies, a lot of them use the Carvana model as an analogy, which is to say that, you know, we started with pants or books and you know, slowly but surely have worked our way up the value chain in terms of the types of goods that, you know, we're willing to, that we feel confident buying online. And, you know, and we have gotten to cars in a way, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, the bet is that houses are next. It's just that I think that, you know, at each new level of value, and it's not just value when it comes to a home. It's value and complication, and there's an emotional component. It just gets more complicated.
What's interesting is, and we've talked throughout the pandemic to real estate agents, realtors, heads of home companies, where they talked about transactions during the deep throes of the pandemic back in 2020, where they did everything online. Everything was a digital transaction. So it can be done, I guess, right?
More and more parts of the transaction can be done digitally, and I think that the pandemic was, I think it accelerated acceptance both by consumers, regulators, lenders, what have you, like that more things can be done virtually, remotely.
Right.
And so I think the pandemic sped this up, no question, but it's one thing to, you know, it's one thing to speed it up, but it hasn't solved the problem.
Creedy, I just want to get rid of that meeting that you have to have with everybody's lawyers, and it's like your lawyers on one side, the sellers on another, or the buyer. Like, I just want to get rid of that part of it.
I have never bought a house, so I cannot relate. Although I will admit, I live in New York City, and I look forward to the days where I can have a white picket fence. That being said, speaking of rental properties, which is what it actually kind of comes to mind as we talk about the pandemic, because a lot of people were actually shopping for apartments via these virtual walkthroughs, and then I wonder how many people actually showed up at the apartment and was like, this is a lot smaller than it looked on FaceTime. I'm curious, Patrick, what's next for this? I mean, is there a solution or is there a money-making prospect when it comes to shopping for houses virtually?
Yeah, I think there's two main ways to think about it. One is, you know, you'll continue to have companies that improve and sort of digitize and bring online components of the transaction, and some of these are the things that we don't really think about. It's the people in the room at the closing date who, you know, you barely understand who they are, but this guy is, you know, this guy has run the title on the home to make sure that the seller, you know, really owns it, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's pieces of it that I think can be very successfully brought into the 21st century here in 2022. And there was also a move to put more and more of these services together. So you have brokerages that are real estate brokerages that are hiring, that are buying or building mortgage lenders internally. You have, traditional mortgage lenders who are starting to offer different types of bridge finance that would allow a buyer to compete like a cash buyer. You have this idea that you can bring all of these things together, and again, going back to this idea of the closing meeting, that basically to simplify and do more of the transaction online with one company, so the consumer's only dealing with sort of one interface. I think there's some promise to that. One of the challenges is it's a lot of technology. It's a lot of process you have to deliver to the customer. And so the question is,
Right.
One, can you build it? And two, can you actually make money doing it? And that's the thing that, you know, hopefully we'll see some progress on.
I look forward to the Uberization of home buying. Hey, Pat, thanks so much. Patrick Clark, real estate reporter at Bloomberg News, on the phone from New York City. Check him out at Twitter at @Pat_Clark.
I'm driving in my car.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive home.
Excuse me, I wanna drive. Keep driving
crazy. It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, TikTok, everybody. About 10 minutes left in today's trading session. We've seen some volatility this week, but certainly a lot more optimism. Bouncing around, though, today, and we are a little bit lower on those major equity averages. So let's get to it. Let's get to the Drive to the Close. Aaron Kennan is back with us, co-founder, chief executive officer at Clear Harbor Asset Management, approximately a little bit more than a billion in assets under management, on the phone once again from Stamford, Connecticut. Hey, Aaron, nice to have you here with Creedy and me. Happy New Year. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me back, Carol. Happy New Year to both of you.
Well, so how do you make sense of what we've seen so far? It's just, you know, what, five, six, seven, eight days in the new year. We're trying to figure out the trend line. I think it's safe to say that it's going to be volatile this year, but who knows? Because I do feel like we got some clarity to some extent from the Fed in terms of what's to come. How do you see it, though?
Well, you know, we're certainly moving into a very different economic, monetary, fiscal environment. You know, we're going from peak growth, which was well above trend last year, 5.6-odd percent, based on Bloomberg consensus, to probably something closer to 3.5 to possibly as high as 4%. But, you know, peak monetary stimulus and peak fiscal stimulus last year towards, you know, much more normalization. Growth's certainly coming down, but also the Fed is unwinding their asset purchases and raising the funds rate, and so, you know, this downdraft, in my opinion, is about, you know, less liquidity in the system. It's probably about more volatility. We should expect that in an environment with less liquidity, and that should be an incremental headwind to PE multiples in the equity market. But that doesn't mean that all is lost this year. Earnings, we still believe, will prove positive, and we certainly are already seeing in the first several trading sessions of the year this sort of sector dispersion like we didn't see last year. And it's not just sort of growth to value, right? It because if you look at what's happening in the equity market, industrials are really doing nothing year to date, but energy's up over 14%. So
it's funny that you say that. I was looking at the S&P 500, the members, and like the seven out of the top 10 names are your energy names. And you're talking about like some incredible gains. I think Hess was up, let me just look at my numbers, like 23, 24%. I mean, each of these names, you're talking some really, really strong gains.
Absolutely. And that's clearly driven by the commodity, which is having a very strong start to the year, up almost 10%. But you know, there's a real question around whether or not the Fed's posture, the market's pricing in what, four rate hikes this year, will prove itself out, or whether or not they're going to ultimately need to put their foot on the brakes with that game plan. You know, I have a hard time believing that this sort of four times this year, three times next year plan is going to play out close to that way.
Why?
I have a hard time believing. First of all, I think inflation will ultimately prove to be, yes, transitory, because supply chain bottlenecks are the cause of, to a great extent, of this inflation. And the headline piece of inflation we're seeing in the rising price of things like oil and natural gas. And that's the area, I think, on the headline, which may remain stubbornly high. But at the core, when we're looking at goods and services, it's a supply chain bottleneck issue that needs to sort itself out. And clearly Omicron, this next variant that is Omicron, has sort of stymied clarity on the reopening trade generally, both home and abroad. And I think it's really delaying this thawing of the supply chain, and it's keeping this inflation question front and center for everyone.
So, Aaron, how many rate hikes are you expecting this year? The dot plot says three. Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan say 4. Jamie Dimon says we need more than 4. Where are you on that spectrum?
Well, the short answer is I don't know. I'm not an economist. I look at the market as my set of sort of.
Does it matter? To you whether it's 3, 4, or 5?
Well, no, it doesn't matter, but it certainly helps us. It informs us. So, what's informing me on the market right now, as it pertains to that question, is where are long-term inflation expectations, where are long-dated Treasury yields, and what has the curve done over the last several days, months, quarters, and what how does this inform us? And I think what the market's telling me is growth is slowing and is going back towards trend over the next year or two. Long-term inflation is not a concern. Short-term inflation is a significant concern. And if the Fed raises rates, they're going to adjust aggregate demand, but they're not going to solve the supply chain bottleneck issue. So it's not clear to me that this rate rise campaign of 4 this year, 3 next year solves the inflation problem. It will only exacerbate the demand side problem, could lead us towards a recession.
So it kind of sounds like you're in the camp of really what Stephanie Flanders was discussing earlier, Carol, in that the likelihood of the Fed getting this wrong is super, super high. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think there's certainly a risk, but I also think that we've learned through Chairman Powell that he's pragmatic, he's willing to pivot, he's not all that stubborn. And we saw that just a couple of years ago. We thought, as the market did, that he was raising rates and too aggressively, and the market finally told him to stop, forced him to stop, and he did. And I think the market has a way of conveying these messages to not only investors but the Fed, and they'll do it again.
Yeah, that is the truth.
So in that sense, I'm optimistic.
Okay. Going to leave it there. Hey, Aaron, nice to check in with you. Aaron Kennan, he's co-founder, chief executive officer at Clear Harbor Asset Management, joining us on the phone from Stamford, Connecticut.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.